that as many of you know, whenever I give a public talk, I don't prepare what I'm going to say, because that's where you can have a much better talk, which involves everybody, and I sort of get in touch with you, find out how you're going, and thereby I can actually move the talk this way and that way for the sake of the audience. And also that many of you have gone to Buddhist schools or read Buddhist doctrines, read the books, and you probably already know the traditional explanations of right view and all these other factors of the Eightfold Path. So I'm going to try and build on what you already know in order to take it deeper. And as far as the right view is concerned, you all know the right view of Buddhism is about the law of karma and rebirth and impermanence, unsatisfactoriness and non-self emptiness. But you all know that already. But do you? Do you really understand what these words mean? You take something like karma, and still people were, these were good Buddhists, they were talking about the end of the world yesterday, and it never happens. And they talk about, oh, it was fated to be. Or some people, they say, oh, I know he's out there somewhere, the love of my life, my other half. Are we fated to be together? Or sometimes you say we're fated not to be together, whatever it is. But is it really fate? Is that really the law of karma? And because people think it's fate sometimes, they say, they were talking to me about this a couple of days ago, is it really true that just some people, they haven't got the spiritual qualities to ordain, to renounce? And that's, many people use that as an excuse. They say, oh, I haven't got enough, they call it parami in Buddhism. You know, that word came a long time after the time of the Buddha. First of all, the Mahayana invented the parami because they had six parami. And then the Theravada, you always have to keep up with the opposition and do better. So they had ten parami, they added a few extra. So that's all where that came from. But when we want to understand something and have a right view about the law of karma, it is something which is not restrictive at all. It's not, oh, it's my karma, therefore I can't become a monk or a nun. Oh, it's my karma, I have to be poor. Oh, it's my karma, I have to put up with that guy who calls himself my husband. No, that. The law of karma is not like that. What I always understood the law of karma, the right view of karma, is that yes, the karma from the past gives you the ingredients of the present. What you've got to deal with now, your wealth, your health, your family, all your education, your knowledge, your understanding, even your abilities to be kind or not to be kind, that's all your past karma gives you the ingredients of right now. But the most important part of karma is what you are doing with what you've got. That is the most important. So yes, you may be poor, but what are you doing with that poverty? Yes, you may be sick or disabled, but what are you doing with that disability? Yes, you may be old, but what are you doing with that old age? It's what you're doing with what you've got is the most important part of the law of karma. And with all the understanding I've got, you know, just, you know, through studies, through practice, through experience, you always find out it doesn't matter what ingredients you have in your life. You can always make something wonderful and beautiful from what you can't. As far as being a monk or a nun is concerned,
We have people like Angulimala. Angulimala, the serial killer. If he was alive today, he'd be notorious. He'd be in high security jail, specially built for him. He was a serial killer.
But he could become fully enlightened.
So, are there any serial killers here this evening? If you're not a serial, if he could become enlightened, surely you can. We have Pakachara, who was crazy. She was out of her skull. And she became enlightened too. Is anyone crazy here this evening?
I think there are a few. We should have visited.
But they became enlightened. So it just shows you that what they had, the people really intelligent and really stupid, all the types became enlightened. So basically, it's what you do with what you've got. One of my favourite stories, which gives hope for people, shows that you can do anything you want with a little bit of skill. One of the famous stories was of this monk. Actually, let's go back in his biography. When he was a young child, this was a Thai story. He went to grade one in school, and after 10 months, however long this stay in grade one with his friends, the teacher had to fail him. Would not be able to send him to grade two. I've never heard of that in my whole life before that someone fails grade one. Have you ever heard of that here in KL? I don't know what they must have done. It must be drawing or plasticine or whatever else they do. But he failed. So the teacher had to keep him back to repeat grade one. And after another year of grade one, the teacher in the best school in the world could not promote him to grade two. So he had to repeat grade one a second, a third time. And that's really stupid. And after 3 years of grade one, even with extra tuition and help, he failed again. So what do you do with someone who is so stupid that can't even pass grade one? That reminds me of another story. There was a story of this this Vietnamese refugee to Australia. And when he went to school, he heard about IQ. So when he came home, he asked his daddy, "Daddy, what does IQ mean? Because in my school here in Australia, I've been hearing about IQ." So his father told him, "But IQ is like a measure of your intelligence. Most people have got average IQ of maybe 100. That's average. If you've got 120 IQ, you probably go to university. If you've got 140, 150, it means you're a genius. You probably become a professor or a doctor or something. If you've only got an IQ of about 80, maybe you just have to work on a building site. IQ of about 40 or 50, it means you're so stupid you won't be able to tie up your own shoelaces." And this Vietnamese boy, does that explain why all Australians wear sandal socks? I can say that because I'm an Australian. But an IQ, this guy, he failed grade one three times, had such a low IQ that even though he lived in a village, they realised he wouldn't probably learn the basics of farming. So they wondered what to do with him. And what they did with him, they ordained him as a novice. Now, not all monks start out like that. But they ordained him as a novice. Because in the temples, now the monks are just so compassionate and patient, much more than a teacher. And the abbot of the local temple really spent a lot of time with this young boy, trying to help him as much as possible. But this boy, he couldn't remember even the chanting. Not even Namo Tassa. He learned Namo, what's the next word? Oh yeah, Tassa, what's the first word again? Even simple things he just could not remember. So after a couple of years in the village temple, the abbot got so frustrated, he sent him to the only place, the last resort for such stupid people, and that was the forest monastery, where I come from. So he sent him to the forest monastery where you learn meditation, not a chanting, you don't learn Pali, just meditation. And when the abbot or the teacher taught him how to meditate, just watch the breath go in, watch the breath go out. This young man had such a simple, clear mind. He could do that without any problem for hours on end. And he soon became fully enlightened with psychic powers, and he became a very famous teacher in Thailand some time ago. So even if you haven't got the brain power, you know, to pass grade one, even so you can make the best use of what you have, and you can even become enlightened. So this is the thing with karma. Is there anyone here who's failed grade one? If any of your kids can't even sort of pass the elementary school, now you know where to send them. Send them to monastery. You may have another enlightened monk or nun there. But that's a true story which shows that it's what you make of what you've got. But that's the most important. And it's also the reason why whatever happens to you in your life, whether you get the sack from work, you've got no work to do, whether your husband sort of is playing around with a mistress, or whether you get a sickness such as a cancer, sometimes we think, oh, that's bad karma. Yes, the ingredients you've got to work with, but as far as Buddhism is concerned, what my view is, what are you doing about that? And you can always do something wonderful with any ingredients of life. You always like to quote or to cite people like Aung San Suu Kyi or Nelson Mandela. Now, Aung San Suu Kyi being under house arrest for years and years and years. Nelson Mandela, 26 years in jail. And it was a hard jail too. And what did he make of that bad karma? He became an inspirational figure for our world. We could forgive. As soon as he got released from jail, a few months later, he was president of the country with power to take revenge on all the people who treated him badly. And did he take revenge? Not at all. He tried to unite that nation. It's a wonderful thing to do. He had a lot of bad ingredients, but he made a wonderful, inspiring life out of it. So where the law of karma works, don't go complaining of what's happening to you. Don't go complaining, it's unfair. Why do I have to have this cancer? It's unfair. Why is it that somebody's cheated me and I've lost all my money? Don't complain. Why is it that, you know, my child died in a car accident? Why? No. What are you doing with what you've got? There's always something you can learn, something you can do. There is some meaning for you to learn, to grow, and become a better human being. That is why, because we always sometimes don't know how to deal with the negative part of life. If you have any negativity in your life, any difficulty, the old story of treading in the dog poo. If you ever go home, and on the way home this evening, you tread in the dog poo. There's many dogs in this temple. It's very likely to happen. Always remember, never scrape it off your shoes. Take it home with you. And only scrape it off under your mango tree in your garden. Because if you scrape off the dog poo under the mango tree, then 1 year later, your mangoes will be sweeter and juicier than ever before. And when you eat those mangoes, and the juice drips down your cheek or mouth, always remember what you are really eating. It is dog food you're eating. It's been transformed. It's a beautiful mango because you brought it home and you dug it in the right place. And that's a simile which I use when you have some bad karma fruiting. Don't just think, oh, poor me, why did this happen? That's not understanding the law of karma. Understanding the law of karma means, yes, here it is now. What am I doing with this? Even the stinkiest, smelliest, dirtiest of dog food. In fact, the more stinky and smelly and dirty it is, the more oomph it's got for your language. So you can see this is how we understand the law of karma. It's such a positive message. It's not faint. It's saying that you can create anything with what life deals you. The future is totally open. You are not restricted at all. It's up to you to make a world which you want to live in. And you can do that no matter what ingredients you have to work with. That's incredibly powerful and positive. And that is the right view. This is the first example you can see what really is right view. Once you hear it, that makes so much sense. It's positive, it's progressive, it gives hope, it encourages good effort, and it reaches a beautiful goal for you and for other people. That has to be right view. Sometimes that we argue with what's right view and what's wrong view. And usually it's the case, my view is right view and your view is wrong view, whoever you happen to be talking with. And this is not just with different religions. This is even people in the same religion. They have all these arguments together. There was this old story of this guy was going home. This is, no, you can use, I'm going to change this story. The guy was going home, you know, from a talk at the temple, and on one of the bridges over one of the rivers, he saw another man who was on the ledge about to jump off and kill himself. And the man said, stop, stop, don't kill yourself like that. And the guy said, don't try and stop me, you come closer and I'll jump straight away. From the accent, he said, you sound like, you know, you're from Hong Kong. I said, yeah, why? I'm from Hong Kong too. Wow, what a coincidence. And then he asked, the guy said, well, don't jump off, it's bad karma. What do you mean bad karma? Are you a Buddhist? Said the guy jumping off. And the guy is trying to say, yeah, I'm a Buddhist too. What type of Buddhist are you? Are you Tibetan? Are you Mahayana? Are you Theravada? And the guy who was trying to stop the guy jumping off said, I'm Theravada. Wow, so am I, said the guy who was about to jump off. What a coincidence. Do you follow Thai tradition? Burmese? Thai tradition, Burmese tradition, Sri Lankan tradition. And he said, I've got a Thai tradition, what about you? Me too! What a coincidence! Is it the forest tradition? Or the Sikh tradition? It's a forest tradition! Me too! This is a great coincidence! It's meant to be! Do you follow Ajahn Brahm? Or do you follow Ajahn Mahabua? And the guy said, I follow Ajahn Mahabua! The other guy said, I follow Ajahn Brahm. Heresy. Get out of here. And he pushed him off. And you will find the closer you are, the more arguments you have. It's very strange. I've seen this. It's very easy for like Theravada monks actually to have a lot of peace and harmony with Tibetan monks and Mahayana monks and even monks from a different, but when you're very close together, really close together, that's where you have the most arguments. Why is that? It is because we have such strong views on what's right and what's wrong, which is one of the reasons why we should be very, very careful of always thinking I am right and the other person is wrong. So what actually is right here? Here is a golden old story. And this is a great story because it actually works. That was the story of the husband and the wife who had just been married. Remember this one? It's a good story. They had just been married, and one afternoon after lunch they were having a walk in the park. And as they were walking in the park, they heard this sound. Quack, quack. Quack, quack. And straight away she said, "Oh, darling, can you hear that? That's a chicken." And he said, "What did you say, darling?" "So that's a chicken." He said, "No, it's not, it's a duck." He said, "No, I'm sure it's a chicken." They went quack, quack again. "There you are, it's a chicken." He said, "Look, it can't be a chicken's. Chickens don't sound like that. Ducks go quack, quack. That was a duck." She said, "No, darling, I am sure that was a chicken." "No, it was not. It was a duck." "It was a chicken." "No, it's a duck. But I'm sure it was a chicken." "No, it's a duck. D-U-C-K. That hurt, duck." And then she started to cry. "Look, it was a chicken." And then in the story, he looked her in the eye. He remembered why he married her. He squeezed her hand gently and said, "Darling, I think you may be right. That is a chicken." And she looked at him and smiled and squeezed his hand also. And they carried on their walk in peace and harmony. And that evening he got dinner. And that was a smart husband. For two reasons. What's most important? Is it important being right about a duck or a chicken? Is that really worth having a divorce over? So no, the love and harmony is more important. So first of all, right view is understanding what's really important tonight. And following that, and sacrificing what's less important. Like who's right and who's wrong. So don't think that, you know, that right view is always being right. Like that man said, "I was looking for the right woman for so many years. I finally found the right woman. And I married her. I call her the right woman because she thinks she's always right." So don't go looking for the right woman. And number two, he was a smart guy, because just because it goes quack quack does not mean that it's a duck. Now, usually, when I started this story, I said it could have been a genetically modified chicken from Fukushima in Japan. But then, later on, because I've told that story for many years, and I've got many supporters, somebody actually emailed me this story, a true story of a chicken who was orphaned and he was adopted by a duck. And this is true, the chicken actually does go quack quack. So that's really true, some chickens do go quack quack. So remember, if you think you're right, and it might turn out you're wrong, which is a big problem why we have arguments. So really right view is understanding we may be wrong. And giving that amount of doubt for you, so you don't need to have arguments, and don't need to have anger, and don't need to have wars. That's why sometimes people can hurt you, be angry at you, be cruel to you, or even cheat you.
There are wonderful ways of overcoming that, of the feeling of being cheated, is to give the other person the benefit of the doubt. Even if you have to stretch the benefit of the doubt, to think, oh, they must be crazy. Oh, they must have misunderstood. Oh, they must be sick today. Whatever it is, give a person the benefit of the doubt rather than accusing them and getting angry at them. Has ever that happened to you? People have scolded you, got angry at you, accused you of things you never ever did? That happens to everybody. And so, the way to overcome that is, I've seen that happen to me, but I don't want to do that to other people. So if somebody, they look like they're cheating me, or they look like they're charging too much, or they look like they're criticizing me, something I never did, I always give them the benefit of the doubt. Oh, they must have been misinformed. They're having a bad day. They must be sick. Whatever it is, giving people the benefit of the doubt solves the problem of having to seek revenge and settle old scores. It allows you to let things go and have some harmony. Because a long time ago, I realized if it really is right view, it must be something which creates harmony between people. If it creates division, there's something wrong. That cannot be right view. So that's a very good litmus test. And so we got something which again we see in the teachings of the Buddha. Another fundamental part of right view is understanding rebirth or reincarnation. You know that some people are absolutely sure there's no reincarnation. And they argue with me. They say, Ajahn Brahm, we really respect Buddhism. It makes so much sense, except for one thing which I cannot accept, and that's reincarnation. How can it be reincarnated? The brain dies. And what gets reincarnated? And instead of having an argument with such people, because sometimes the argument gets you nowhere, just wastes a lot of time, I just usually tell them, it doesn't matter. Don't make a big deal about reincarnation. I don't care if you don't believe in reincarnation, because I will certainly know that you will believe in reincarnation in your next life. And I also tell them, if I'm wrong, the Buddha was wrong, there's no reincarnation, after you die, you can come and see me and tell me, I told you so.
They can't do that, can they?
That is why, and we're always trying to raise money, the BTF is trying to raise money, all Buddhist temples try to raise money for this, that and the other. So I propose this to my committee. Because eventually, we have a membership, annual membership, we have a life membership now. And I think you get paid 4 or 5 years annual fees and you get life membership forever. So, well, we're Buddhists. Why don't we have 7 life memberships? Only 4 times a life membership. You have a life membership for the BTF? How much is it, the life membership?
1,000
ringgit. Well, look, if you pay 4,000 ringgit, then you get 7 lives, free membership. So pay for 4, you get 3 for free. Isn't that a great deal? I think we could market that. Buy 4, get 3 for free. So for some reason, they wouldn't agree to that.
It's very hard to say, yeah, that was me and my past life, I've already paid. Prove it.
So instead of having arguments, let's open the possibility that you could be reborn from another life, another place.
But that's a right view. But sometimes to be able to find out whether that's a true view or a wrong view. Because people have so many different views in this world. There were some genuine people, even some Buddhists, really thought that the world was going to end yesterday. You can't believe that. These were intelligent people. They believed stupid, stupid things. And you know, sometimes, as a scientist, as a physicist, I just couldn't understand when I was growing up how people can believe such incredible things which are obviously nonsense. Until I learned about Buddhism and the psychology of the mind. You know how the mind actually works? You believe what you want to believe. And much of all the views is what you want to believe in. And the things which you don't like, that you just cannot believe in, even if it happens to be true. And the obvious examples of that, number one, falling in love. How many of you, when you were young, were romantic? You wanted to find the guy of your dreams. And what did you end up with? The boy of your nightmares. That was a good dream. It's a wrong kind of dream, damn it. So, or you want to find the girl of your fantasies. Somebody was saying recently, you know, all these famous people all becoming Buddhists. Somebody told me, I think Agnes Cajato told me that Sarah Jessica Parker, from Sense of the City, she was seen reading my book, Opening the Door of Your Heart. So she's a follower now. Now Sarah Jessica of Sense of the City. So I'm waiting for the lender to invite me to do an appearance. Would that be a good idea? Perhaps I have a special episode. Instead of Sex in the City, no sex in the monastery. You know, somebody has said to me that there was a supermodel, Kate Moss. You heard of Kate Moss?
Yeah,
really supermodel. She's supposed to be drop dead gorgeous. She went to this meditation retreat. A lot of these people into meditation. And one of the friends I know went on the same retreat. He was told, hey, Kate Moss is on this retreat. So he went looking for her. And all the girls that he could recognize her. Because when you take off all the makeup, all the airbrushing, she just looks like another girl. And it was amazing. I could not recognize who she was until someone pointed out, it's Kate Moss. Now this is what happens with your fantasies. Apparently, was it here a couple of years ago? Was it what changed one? I think we had was it a supermodel? Yeah, I think
it was a
supermodel.
One of the beauty queens
was here on this retreat. That's why we had, usually we have mostly girls on the retreat, but this retreat had a lot of boys. Anyway, but someone told me I couldn't recognize who she was. So this is actually boy fantasy. You make these fantasies up of what they really are, but it's not true. You see what you want to see. And also what you don't want to see, you just cannot see that. If you have an enemy, especially when people are going through divorces. I don't know if you've been through a divorce. It's one of the most difficult times, unless you're a good Buddhist. And just sort of, it doesn't matter. These relationships, they begin, they end. It's internal like everything else. You can't expect every relationship to last forever and ever. And that idea that when you get married, darling, till death us do part, you say no to any child us do part. 15 minutes. Sometimes these things, they last a long time, sometimes a short time. But it's romantic, isn't it? We want to believe that this is a person I'm going to spend the rest of my life. And some people do that. Some do Buddhist marriages. They say in Australia, no, we're going to be together in our next life as well. And the one afterwards, and the one afterwards. And the wife says, no way. One way to do that. But when you do have a divorce, sometimes because you're so close together, and because some of the deepest of your hopes and dreams are destroyed, that really hurts. Especially if you think that it's going to be there forever. And your expectations are destroyed. That hurts so much. When it hurts so much, so often, that person you married, instead of seeing what you saw when you first got married, which is all their beauty and wonderful, you can't see anything redeemed in them at all. And you keep asking yourself, why on earth did I marry that person? I must have been stupid. And of course, you were stupid. You didn't see what they were really like. These days, people are a bit more, at least they should be, a little bit more open-eyed when you go into relationships. Which is why I always tell people, when you have a relationship, please lower your expectations. Don't raise them. If you raise your expectations and think that you're so lucky you've got this incredible great guy who's never going to argue with you and is going to care for you and is always going to be there for you and is always going to speak nice things to you. No, if you've got a person, that's what actually I thought when I was a young man. When I was a young man, you know, you were still not that sure whether you're going to stay as a man. But one day, one of my best friends, he decided to get married. And I thought, why don't I do the same? And I thought, well, let's just think, what type of girl would I like? And then I said, she has to be really, really gorgeous. And number two, she must never argue with me. She must always be ready to do what I want when I like to do it. And she must... When I had all of these, I realized that the only girl I could actually marry was someone who had no personal desire, no ill will at all. She never got angry with me. Totally selfless. She'd have to be enlightened. Then I realized if she's enlightened, she would have no lust. So it's a waste of time. Well, you know. You're always going to marry someone who's imperfect. If they've got lust, they've also got anger and ill will. So have both, okay? So remember, lower your expectations and understand what you're getting. But when we do get divorced, all we can ever see in that person is their bad qualities. And sometimes you counsel people, look, he's a really great guy. You don't know him, Ajahn. You've never lived with him. You've been like I am. You would never say that. But that's not true. There's never anybody who's that bad that need to be destroyed like that. But when you have anger, you can't see anything good in that person at all. When you get anger at anything, your mind becomes distorted. And you can't have light view. Which is one of the reasons I realize that all the different views, what people argue with, what people fight wars over, is all because of craving and ill will distorting their minds. Not realizing it doesn't matter if it's a chicken or a nut. It doesn't matter if God is called this word or that word. What really matters is harmony and peace in this world. That is much more important. That's right for you. What creates harmony. And one of the core teachings, which again you've heard many times, but it comes in this part of the talk, because these talks are always recorded and they go all over the place and I don't know where they end up. Many of you have heard this story before. Other people may have listened to it for the first time. But this one is a powerful one. It actually opens up solutions to very deep-seated problems. And that was the story of the container and the contents. They began with a telephone call I got in Perth many years ago. It was a journalist from the Australian newspaper who was doing an article over the scandal of US Marines in Guantanamo Bay taking a copy of the Holy Quran, putting it in the toilet and flushing it down the toilet. And the journalist said he was contacting all the senior leaders of the religions in Australia to find out what their reaction would be to the same question. He'd gone through the Christians and the Jews, the Hindus and the Muslims, and then now he was actually getting the Buddhists. So I was well known as a Buddhist leader. And also I could speak English, so you know, you could actually understand what I was saying. So he asked me, Ajahn Brahm, you're the last person, the last religion. What would you do, Ajahn Brahm, if someone took a Buddhist holy book and flushed it down your toilet? Without any hesitation, I replied, if someone flushed a Buddhist holy book down my toilet, sir, the first thing I would do is call the plumber. And he thought that was very funny. He said that was the first sensible answer he got all day. And he published that. Real practical. But that's when I also started to develop this idea of the container and the contents. I said you can destroy as many Buddhist holy books as you like. You can blow up as many Buddhist statues. You can destroy even the temples, put graffiti over the Buddhist statues like some people have done in Korea. You can even kill the Buddhist monks and nuns. But I will never allow you to kill Buddhism. I will never allow you to flush peace, compassion, forgiveness, truth down the toilet. Because the statue is a content. The monks and the nuns... Sorry, the statue is a container, sorry. The statue is a container. What does the statue represent? Peace, forgiveness, kindness. So why do we sacrifice kindness when a Buddha statue is destroyed? You don't need to do that. When we understand the difference between the container and the contents, you can destroy as many containers as you like. You can blow up Buddha statues. You can put graffiti over the temples. That's not desecrating Buddhism. It only desecrates the teachings if you sacrifice and give up your kindness, your forgiveness, your peace, your forgiveness, especially forgiveness. So never sacrifice the contents for the container. You can always get more containers. When the big Buddha statue in Bamiyan was destroyed, it took about 3 or 4 days to destroy that statue. In the meantime, throughout the world, about 1,000 statues were produced in those 3 or 4 days. So the Buddhists still made a profit. We lost one, we gained 1,000. But this is actually where we understand what is really important in life, and that is the right view. So going through like a divorce, or someone's cheated you, or you've got a cancer, what is more important? The cancer? The divorce? Who's right or who's wrong? Or things like peace, compassion, forgiveness, harmony. If you have the view to understand what's really important, even through a divorce, you will never destroy the Dhamma. You can forgive and let go. Whoever's wrong, you don't need to punish them. You don't need to seek revenge. That's the job of karma. Karma will do that. So you just let it go. Karma will sort them out. If, again, if you believe in a God, then God will sort that out. You don't need to punish people. Which means your job is to forgive. The job of a human being is to forgive. Move forward, never linger on the past. Try and learn from what went wrong. Be wiser next time. But punishment, that has no part. That's not the responsibility of a human being. If you're a Buddhist, it's karma's job. If you believe in a God, that's God's job. Not human beings. Your job is to make sure it never happens again. Whatever, however you do that. So, this becomes what we call right view. It leads to harmony and peace in our world. Solves the problems of our world. When harmony is more important than being right, then maybe people can actually live together in peace and harmony. And if they do separate, there's no ill will after a marriage breaks down. You know, you give your best, both of you. Give each other the benefit of the doubt. You try. Now, maybe you thought the other person would try harder. You could have tried harder as well. It's just even. So let it go. Learn, move on, grow, and do a better job next time. So this is actually how what we learn from these things. And that way, we don't sacrifice real Buddhist teachings. Peace, harmony, love, forgiveness. It gets deeper than that. Now that's my reincarnation, and that's the right attitude. Only you mentioned peace being so important. That's some of the reason why that when we talk about Buddha statues, even last week I was giving a couple of nights ago in Melbourne, giving a talk to people because they were asked, why do you Buddhists go bowing to statues all the time? Or bowing to monks? Or bowing to this and bowing to that? You're always bowing. Why do you do that? And it's a very easy answer to that. We bow because the more times we bow, the more we actually exercise our tummy muscles, which means we don't get so fat. These days, people bow to me, so I'm so sick I don't get the chance to bow to too many people these days. That's why I put on weight. In the old days, I was always bad for this much and bad for that much. That's why I didn't. But the serious answer was that it's what the Buddha statue represents. I'm not bound to the container, I'm bound to the content. And to me, the Buddha stands for virtue, peace and compassion. Sometimes wisdom is both compassion. But any time I bow first time I remember virtue. And how wonderful virtue is. Honesty. Trust. And people, you can leave your money there and you know they will not take it. And that is such a beautiful thing to see in our world when people are virtuous, trustworthy. They're good people. Because when there's good people in this world, it means we can relax, we can walk home, know we're not going to get robbed or attacked. Isn't that wonderful to have that? We don't need to have some security on our houses. Some houses have got so many bars, I think they must be living in prison. Isn't that a terrible thing to do? When I was young, even my father, he would hardly ever lock the door of our house. But that was because there was nothing in there to steal anyway. But it's terrible we have to secure everything because we can't trust anybody. But when we have virtue, when we have trust, it means that even we can send our kids to school know that no gunman is going to shoot them all like happened in the United States. That lack of virtue, that lack of trust, now means in many of those places, going into school you have to pass with gun detectors, metal detectors. When I go onto the aircraft you have to pass with all the security stuff. Just because we don't trust each other anymore. That lack of virtue in our world causes so much hassles and trouble to everybody. So when there is a virtuous community, where goodness, trust increases, what a wonderful world that becomes. So it's the first time I bow, I bow to virtue. Every time I put my head down, virtue is higher than me, which means I respect it. I worship, I venerate it. So every time I bow to Buddha, the first time I bow to virtue, it means psychologically it strengthens it. I remember, this is important to me. And then the second time I bow to peace. Peace is such a wonderful thing to have in this world. Peace between countries, so the countries don't need to be worried about each other, who's going to invade who. Imagine how much money would be saved when we don't have to have such big armies and navies. Always worried about, who's got the best arms. We can have peace. I always remember, when I was young, the Swedish government, I really respected them because they were so close to the Soviet Union. But their defense policy cost, I think, $1. That's all they spent on the defense. This is actually true, it's not a joke. They knew if the Soviet Union would attack them, they'd have no possibility of defending themselves. The Soviet Union at that time had more tanks and soldiers and aircraft and ships. There's no way they could compete. So their defense budget was just to have a recording on the old tapes saying, "We surrender." That cost them $1. They saved a lot of money that way. They wouldn't win anyway, so just, okay, we surrender. That's apparently true, they did have that. That's a really powerful defense budget. So if China attacks Malaysia, so Malaysia won't be able to defend itself, so they should have a budget of $1 million. Excuse me, I bet I'll get in trouble here somewhere. But you see, like, peace is so important between people. And just peace in the home as well. Sometimes people argue so much at home. You always can tell how long a person's been married. In the first year of marriage, the husband listens to the wife. Actually, the other way around. First year, the wife listens to the husband. In the second year of marriage, the husband listens to the wife. In the third year of marriage, the neighbours listen to both of them because they're arguing so loud. So isn't it wonderful to have a nice peaceful home? After a busy day at work, through the traffic, you can come to a place of peace where you can relax and you don't have to defend yourself, you're not being challenged, you're not being argued. It's just a nice place where you can live together in peace. When you see that, it's such a wonderful thing. It's great for me. I've got a monastery which is a peaceful monastery. Everyone gets on together. No, one of the reasons why is because we laugh a lot. You know, we tell jokes. Some of the jokes we say are just terrible jokes. I actually shared one of those this Christmas time. I got away with this as well. It was Christmas time, so three people, just the day before Christmas, they were involved in a car accident, and they died, and they went up to heaven together, the three of them. And because it was Christmas, the angel at the gate said, "If you want to get into heaven at Christmas time, you have to show me something to do with Christmas." So the first person thought for a while, and they got out the cigarette lighter, and they lit it, said, "Christmas candle." It's like a Christmas candle. And the angel said, "Well, okay, you can get in." The second one took out their car keys. And they jingled them. "Jingle bells, jingle bells." "Well, okay, that will do. You can go in." And the third guy, he put up in his pocket, and he got his girlfriend's underpants. her underwear. And the angel said, "What's that?" He said, "It's Carol's." Carol! His girlfriend was called Carol! Carol! Have you ever noticed when you tell a joke and we laugh, we all laugh together? It's a wonderful way of creating harmony, having a lot of laugh together. And that creates a peace. When you have peace in a monastery, it's such a wonderful place to get back to. You know that there's going to be no arguments, there's no sort of jealousies, but people are at peace together. So please, have a lot of laughter in your house. Laughter in the place you work as well. And tell that joke to your friends when you come back. and then it creates a lot of peace and harmony. You can't get angry and laugh at the same time. So understanding that, we crave peace. That's what I worship. I worship peace. But most of all, peace in my heart. And peace in your mind as well. Peace of mind. That's the thing which most people search for in this life. And to have peace of mind, really, you don't find it in relationships. You don't find it in having kids. You certainly don't find it in
being wealthy or being famous. You find peace of mind just by sitting down and meditating. It doesn't matter what you've got, who you are. It's amazing how easy it is when you know the secret just to make peace with yourself. If you understand with all of your faults and all your silly traits, you can love yourself to bits as you are and be totally at peace with yourself. Not trying to change anything at all. And I know that peace very well. That's why I worship it. Oh, I would love peace. And because you're at peace, you've got all this energy and time for others, which is why I worship compassion, number three. So when I bow down, the third thing, I bow down to compassion and kindness. How wonderful it is just to take a little time out and be kind. And every time that I've sacrificed myself just to be a little bit more compassionate, it's one of the reasons I'm sorry I didn't go to Penang this time. Usually, you know, what I do is 1 year, you teach a retreat in KL and do a tiny retreat in Penang. The other time, go into Penang, give a retreat. But this time, I never gave a small retreat in Penang because the daughter of one of my friends, her father died. I wanted to do a memorial service for him. And I couldn't bring myself to say no because it was so important to her. And even though I had to sacrifice in Penang, he had to sacrifice as well. Such a beautiful thing. So it's kindness, compassion. So I'd always go out of my way to do it out of compassion. Never get tired afterwards when you've been kind. And compassion brings beauty to the world. You forgive, you do the extra for somebody when you don't need to. I was saying this morning about that priest from the United States who was caught being kind. Okay. Giving some food to a person who was homeless. And that was the best thing I've read in the newspaper. All the rest, corruption and race and wars and politics, oh, it just sent you crazy. But to see an article about a policeman who out of his own pocket just gave a pair of shoes to someone who was had no shoes at all. You know how cold New York is at this time of the year? Freezing. What a beautiful thing to do. So that's why I worship compassion. So that way, my view is, what I'm actually building up is something very powerful every time I bow. I'm bowing to virtue, peace and compassion, which means it, these qualities strengthen inside of me. And I know that the view about reincarnation, the view about karma, the view about what is the right religion, or if you're a Buddhist, what is the right type of Buddhism? Should we be following Kuan Yin? Should we be worshipping Maitreya? Should we be... Well, it just gets endless. Can't we all agree on virtue, peace, and compassion? When I tell that, Christians, they can bow to a Buddha. It's very easy because they're bowed to something which they believe in as well. You'll always find when it's really right for you, everybody will join in. And when everybody joins in, that's a sign. It's harmonious. It is right view. And it does lead to the very end to enlightenment. When you start worshipping virtue, you become a really, really good person. When you worship peace, your meditation really takes off. And as I said this morning or this afternoon, that peace gets so deep. So powerful. You never thought that peace could be so peaceful. And then compassion, the beautiful kindness. We can be kind to the whole world, even stupid people like myself. You can be compassionate to your own stupidity and to all your faults. Yeah, I'm not so perfect. Sometimes I say the most stupid of jokes. That's alright, I can't wrong. I still love you. It's all right. You can be such open-hearted to yourself. And you understand what the meaning of peace of mind is. And the deep stillness. The end of suffering. The enlightenment itself. All through a very simple path. So that is why the right view is not espousing just what you've read in the books. because other people have got different books, and every Buddhist has got a different book, and every Buddhist has got a different understanding of what they read in their different books. And there's so many differences, it never creates any peace and harmony in our world. But when you actually see what is truly right view is what creates peace and harmony, liberation and freedom. And actually, you know, that's what the Buddha said. In his advice to Mahaprajapati, the first Bhikkhuni, he repeated this to the Vinaya expert in Pali, both of whom became fully enlightened. He said, you know it's the truth. You know it's the Dhamma. If that particular view leads to peace, upasana, leads to harmony, leads to freedom, leads to letting go of all these negative things, it leads to the cessation of the dukkha, leads to enlightenment. Then you know that, that was the teaching of the Buddha. Very beautiful saying. It creates harmony. So there you go. Now you have right view. There's only another 7 factors to go. And they will be coming in the next 7 days. So thank you for listening. Now we have the questions. We've got to finish that half. So can someone bring the basket in with the questions outside the door? But while we're waiting for those, has anyone got a question? A live question from the audience? No? Okay. So, here we go. The team. And the lucky first question is number... And I always say when I ask these questions, I always like giving a prize to the best question every evening. And that prize will be the free haircut. No one ever takes up that prize. Here we go. There are many approaches, teachings of getting into meditation. For example, meditate on the breath. Meditate on sound. Meditate on one single object and many more. Can Ajahn share some hints or advice on the path of meditation? Yes. See, what I do, sometimes, first of all, I teach people like how to meditate on the breath. If they can't do that, they can't say it's too difficult, then I teach them Anapanasati. And if they can't do Anapanasati, then I teach them loving kindness meditation. If they can't do loving kindness, then I teach them metta meditation. If they can't do metta, then I teach them like body meditation, sweeping the body. If they can't do that, then I teach them Kayagatasati. And if they can't do that, then I teach them letting go meditation. And if they can't do that, then I teach them breath meditation. By that time, they can't remember that's where they started. And the reason you can do this is because they're all the same. There's no difference. Because, and this is a serious point, it's not what you are observing in meditation which is important. You can be observing your breath or your body or sounds or observing loving kindness. That's not important. What's important is how you are observing it. It's not the what, but the how. Even if you're seeing beautiful lights in the mind, I don't care if you're seeing beautiful lights, but what are you doing with that? How are you watching it? Are you really making peace, being kind, being gentle? Are you letting go? Or are you holding on, wanting? It doesn't matter what you're experiencing. It's how you experience it. It's the key to success in meditation. So if you know how to let go, to be kind, to be peaceful, it doesn't matter what you're watching. Breath, sounds, body, loving kindness, limiters, the lights, I don't care what you're watching, it's how you're watching it. That is the key to meditation. So you can do any of these meditations, they're all the same. It's how you do it. That's most important.
Next question. Dear Ajahn Brahm, I am an artist. Is Buddhist non-self compatible with art's self-expression? Does it mean that all artworks are suffering, attachment, and impermanent? Thank you. No. Instead of doing self-expression, do no self-expression. Someone sent me a cartoon. It's great. Now Buddhism is becoming very popular in the West. We have cartoons. And they have a cartoon of a Buddhist restaurant. They had two lines. One was for the lay people, that was self-service. The other one was for the monks, no self-service. That's really clever. So if you're enlightened, you go on the other line, no self-service. And the arts and self-expression, it's not self-expression. Who's expressing these things? It's just what comes out. And I think that you will probably understand that if you're an artist, if there's any part of you there, any self, the painting, the sculpture, or the music doesn't come out. And I know this because when I give talks, I have to disappear to give a talk so the Dharma can come out. If Ajahn Brahm is involved, no, it doesn't work. And that's even meditating. Sometimes I say this as a bit of a joke, but then given a deeper meaning, I put my hand up and say, I can't meditate. I can't get into jhanas. Ajahn Brahm can't get into jhanas. He wrote all these books about jhanas. I can't meditate. I can't watch my breath. I have to disappear first of all. When Ajahn Brahm disappears, all these things happen. That's how I meditate. Bye-bye, Ajahn Brahm. And then meditation happens. That's how it works. Instead of giving a talk, if I'm going to give a really good talk, I have to disappear. Get into no self. If you want to do a piece of music, if you're performing, many great performers have told me this. They practice, but when they're on the stage, they're with that piano, they have to vanish. They have to let the music play. Let it flow. Because if they get in the way, and they're worried about what they're doing, if that self appears, it goes wrong. So whoever is asked this question as an artist, see if you can meditate until you vanish. And if you say like painting, then let the brush, do the painting. And you're not there. Then that is no self-expression. It's amazing what comes out. Sometimes what comes out of my mouth. You know, I've done this many times, giving a talk. I said, well, that was profound. Where did that come from? It didn't come from me, that's for sure. It's amazing what comes out sometimes. So that's my artwork, giving talks. So your artwork, disappear. Then you find incredible stuff comes out.
The next question.
Is it possible to get into a jhana state without a nimitta or light? It's much easier to get into jhana with a light. Is it possible to get to Australia without getting into aircraft? It is. You know, you can walk down to Johor, you walk across the causeway, you go to sort of the south of Singapore and start swimming. It's possible. But I wouldn't recommend it. Especially there's so many cheap airlines now, Tiger Air and all this other stuff. So yeah, it's possible to get into jhana without a nimitta or a light. But if you want the easy way, then get into these lights, these nimittas, that's the best. Dear Ajahn, can a person who passed away take others with him? Then they call that mutual suicide. That's interesting. Can a person who passed away take others with him? I wonder what you mean by that. Sometimes you ask these questions and you ask these questions. You say a funny story first of all, and then try and think what they really mean. Maybe, do you mean that they pass away together and they get, sort of try and get reborn together? And sometimes that happens. They've got such a close connection to one another. They actually come back really, really close. Well, it's a weird story, but I like giving weird stories. And one of the weirdest stories, because our previous president of our Buddhist society, Dennis, he does all sorts of interesting stuff. He's into astronomy, and then about 4 or 5 years ago, he decided to learn hypnotism. And you know, he's one of these guys, whatever he does, he's good at everything. And so he learned the ropes, and then he starts, you know, his own hobby, just hypnotizing people and getting them into their past lives. You know, he's actually, you know, helped a lot of people. But he went to a seminar, you know, of hypnotists who do regression therapy in Sydney. And he came back with this amazing story of one hypnotist who had a client who was anorexic. I often say to people, I'm anorexic too, you know. It is absolutely true, because one day I was reading a newspaper about the definition of anorexia. And what actually it is, and the definition of anorexia is you look in the mirror and you think you're fat. Okay, that's me. I'm anorexic, so I need to eat more. Well, okay, that's not really a joke. This was a person who really was anorexic. He was really, really thin. And wasn't eating. Doctor couldn't help her. Psychiatrist, psychologist couldn't help her. Out of desperation, her mother took her to this hypnotist. Who knows, maybe it's something to do with the past life. And of course it was. Because this hypnotist, she was a girl, very easily hypnotized, and she went back into her previous life, where she related that she was the younger of two sisters. And the two sisters fell in love with the same guy. Her elder sister was more beautiful. She was plain. And because of that, boys being boys, the boy chose the elder sister and married her elder sister. She was so heartbroken that she committed suicide. And that was the reason why she was so desperate to be beautiful, because of the pain the lack of being attractive had caused her in her previous life. That's why she was anorexic. Desperately going over the top trying to be attractive, because of how much it hurt her in her previous life. And it gives a good idea where these things come from. The interesting part of this story was the reaction of the mother hearing this from her daughter. It was the mother who was hysterical. And when the psychologist, the hypnotist, calmed the mother down, said, "Why are you crying, being so hysterical?" And that's when the mother said, "I was that older sister. I never told my daughter this, because this was before she was born. I had a younger sister who fell in love with the same guy. That's her father, my husband. I married him, and my younger sister was so heartbroken she killed herself. And she wanted to be close to that man so much that she couldn't be his wife. She became his daughter." And that's how these things work. You know, we get so attractive, want so much, that we do sometimes come back together. So it's the power of desire. We do actually come back, life after life, the same little group of people, friends, which reunited again. Here we are again. Oh no, not again. Any tips? Guidelines to develop stillness of mind. Yes, don't do anything. Sit there and shut up. And number two, don't be afraid. Because a lot of times, many of you during this retreat will start to become peaceful. And it's such a strange experience to you. You'll destroy because you're afraid. Just like many people become happy in their life, and they become afraid of happiness. Something must be wrong. I'm happy. Something must be wrong. There's no problems. Something must be wrong. Things are going right. It's amazing how many people destroy happiness because they're afraid. Fear, I'll probably give a talk on this later on. Fear is one of the biggest problems in our life. We're afraid of being free. In the same way a prisoner who's been in jail for 20, 30 years is afraid of being free. They're not used to it. This is why many prisoners prefer to stay in jail rather than leave those gates and face a world in which they don't feel comfortable. They learn how to live in prison. We're used to it. We learn about suffering. We get used to it. We take that suffering away. Something, no, please don't do that. I first learned that when years and years and years ago, I was invited to give a keynote address at a grief and loss conference. Now, trying to deal with people who had pathological grief. Someone had died in their family in terrible situations, terrible circumstances. They just could not let go. It was destroying their health and also their business. They couldn't do anything because they were just so upset year after year after year. Now, grief is okay when it just lasts for a week or 2 weeks or a month or 3 months or 6 months. When it goes to 3 or 4 years and you still haven't let go of the grief, that's really pathological. That's going too far. And so they had conferences such as this where psychologists, doctors, in my case monks, can actually put in some input and try and solve the problem of people who would feel so grief-stricken it's destroying their life. And of course I got some great methods, very powerful teachings to let go of the grief. And I presented them and most people really appreciated them. They're coming from a Buddhist perspective. But this one woman, she must have been in her 50s, came up to me afterwards and just eyeballed me. And she was so angry. She was shouting at me, "How dare you try and take away my grief? How dare you try and make me happy?" she was saying. And I was really shocked. That was the first time I saw really close up how people can get attached to their suffering. So much so that anybody who tries to take away their suffering, to take away their grief or their guilt, challenges them so much it makes them angry. How dare you try and make me mad? That's why we're afraid of peace. Sometimes we're afraid of happiness. But that's one of the reasons why people can't be still. They're going out of their comfort zone. You all know how to worry. Which is why it's hard for you to let it go. What would life be like if you didn't worry about anything? That'd be terrible, I'd have nothing to do. What would life be like if you were happy? Well, I couldn't moan at anybody. I couldn't tell people, "Oh, I feel terrible today," and get any sympathy. So be careful. A lot of times the reason why people aren't still because of fear of the unknown. Going beyond your prison. It's a scary thing to do. You stay here and I will lead you out into the freedom beyond the walls. That's actually how the episode. Okay, 2 more questions and 5 minutes to go. During meditation I have a lot of thoughts. How do I overcome this? Very easy. How do you stop talking? You just shut up. So tell your mind, shut up, okay? And if anybody breaks a noble silence, you're allowed 3 times, and the 3rd time you have to come up to me, and we get out masking. We're allowed to leave a little hole there with a straw so you can still drink water and you can have soups. So you've got this masking tape around you for the rest of the retreat because we don't want to.
No, I'm sure they won't do that. But you never know, there's always a first time. The way to overcome thoughts is not to try and stop the thinking, but just to let it be. To say it's none of my business. That's wonderful, you know, because sometimes people ask you, can you ask a question? So, no, I don't know that, so don't bother, he knows those answers. And sometimes I pass them on to somebody else. That's why any complaints on this retreat, any complaints, please see the organisers. See the organisers. Any compliments, come and see me. So, these thoughts in the mind, they're not yours. I don't know where they come from, but they're nothing to do with me. So if you see a thought coming in the mind, say to it, none of my business. Anything to do with the past? None of my business. Anything to do with the future? None of my business. Anybody ask you a question? None of my business. Isn't that wonderful if you go to work and people keep saying, well, not my job. So any thoughts, none of your business. The only business you have is peace. Any thoughts, when you say that, none of my business, you take away the attachment. It's my thought. It's really important. It's my thought. When it becomes mine, that's when it's a problem. If it's somebody else's thought, it's not my problem. When you go to somebody else's house and it's a mess, do you get out of the vacuum cleaner and vacuum it for them? Have you ever been to somebody's house and just wash the dishes for them? It's your job to wash the dishes, not mine, I'm a new visitor. So, it's none of my business. This is actually a little way of looking which I've developed. It's simply of being a visitor, not an owner. Because this was happening in monastery over in Perth. I was always busy in my own monastery. And people coming up and saying, oh, what a peaceful monastery you have. I said, peaceful monastery? You should see how much work I have to do. And they'd all say, this is a beautiful, what do you mean a beautiful monastery? Can't you see all the things which need to be done? Because I was an owner, there was always work to be done. But when someone visited, they said it was beautiful. So I decided one morning a week, I would be a visitor to the monastery in which I lived. I'd see the whole thing with the same idea as a visitor. And you know, the visitors were right, it was beautiful when you didn't own it. And I'd try and do that, teach that to people in their homes. One afternoon a week, go in your home as if you were a visitor. So any dirty dishes, not my problem, I don't know the same. Any garden, not my garden. Non-self-so, got nothing to do, I'm a visitor. And if you treat your own home like a guest would treat it, then you can actually enjoy your house. It's not just a place of work. And then, do the same technique with your mind. It's not my mind. I'm just a visitor. What's the thing? It's okay with me. Dirty dishes, all right with me. I'm not going to clean up anything. I'm just going to go in my mind as a visitor, not as an owner. Then you find most of the thoughts will disappear. Most of the problems will disappear. If it's your mind, you've got a big problem. Stupid, tired, restless, fantasizing, dreaming, getting angry, what? It's your mind, it's a big problem, you have lots of work to do. If you're only visiting, no work at all. Peace, at last. So look at your mind like a visitor, not as an other. Non-self. Dear Jambal, there was a study which said that people with psychopathic tendencies, e.g., as I'm wrong, no? That's okay. Have a brain that is different from normal people. Hence, is it possible for a psychopath to change and be good if he is physiologically engineered to be bad? If yes, how? Meditation changes your brain.
It's called a plastic brain. There's books have been written about that. Once you start with a brain, you're not stuck with that for the rest of your life. You know, you can actually grow it. Meditation has been shown to grow the cortex. Now, the brain. Now, this was a study done in Boston, next to a big meditation center. The scientist was doing MRIs of people's brains over many years, after 6 or 7 years. They found out, not just one, many of the meditators, their cortex had actually got bigger. Literally, more megabytes between your ears. Literally. It was actually changing. So the brain is plastic. It can be changed. So you can change a psychopathic brain into the brain of a compassionate Buddha. Just like Angulimala. So again, just because you've got a brain of a particular type, that's the ingredients you've got to work with. You can change it into the brain of a Buddha. Just through meditation and some very good teachings. So you're not stuck. Even an Adam Lanza, he got killed, he killed himself, even he could become an enlightened being. Just like Angulimala. Last question. What do we do as Buddhists when someone is possessed by a ghost? It's not my brain. Not my brain. I'm only a visitor. Somebody else's problem. So what do you do? Number one, take them to psychologists or psychiatrists. Because in my life, 99% of the time, it's not possession by a ghost. It is just a psychotic episode. So a little bit of drugs actually helps much more than going and doing some chanting. But a few times when it is a real possession, I've seen those possessions, especially this time of year. This time of the year is the most dangerous years. Dangerous time of people being possessed by spirits. It's called the bottle ghost, remember? It lives in bottles of whiskey, tiger beer, and all these other alcohol which people take at this time of the year. And you know it's possessed by a spirit because people talk in a very strange way. They can't even walk in a straight line when the spirit possesses them. And sometimes it kills them because they're driving along the road drunk and they die. That's why it's called the bottle ghost, and this will eat them. If you see anyone possessed by spirits, then you know what to do. Tell them to give up alcohol and keep the 5 precepts, for goodness sake. That's a dangerous spirit. That's why whiskey is called spirits. So other ghosts have nothing to do with you. They are lower beings. They're not high beings. So it's very rare. The only time they can actually get into a person is if a person is very, very weak, sick. So they've got no real strength inside them. Normal people can't get possessed. And I know this for a fact, that ghosts are scared of you. And then the simile I give, which is very accurate, is why is an elephant scared of a mouse? It makes no sense at all, but elephants are scared of mice because they're stupid. Now the elephant just needs to tread on that mouse and the mouse is toast. can a mice kill an elephant? No way, but elephant can kill a mouse. It's so easy. But still, the elephant is scared of the mouse. You are like elephants. Some more than others. And the mouse is like the ghost. So why the mouse can scare the elephant, why the ghost can scare the human being is crazy. You have far more power. If you ever see a ghost, exert that power. You tell the ghost what to do. If the elephant wasn't afraid, the elephant could scare the goats, the elephant could scare the mouse to help. You can do the same with a ghost. If you ever see a ghost, you tell them. Ghost, if you mess around like this, you'll be in big trouble. Get out! Look! And if you don't show fear, the ghost will have to come. Realizes that you have far more power than the ghost has. Ghost is a lower being. You're a much higher being than that. It's only sometimes because of our culture we get afraid. We have no reason to get afraid. So if you don't see any ghost, you tell it what for. And you warn it, if you don't behave, ghost, I will tell Ajahn Brahe. No, please don't! Then the ghosts will laugh. Right? I always remember that story with Kodama Chief Reverend, because we had a whole talk on ghosts one evening. It was one of the great talks. So many people came to listen to that talk at Brickfields, and so many ghosts as well. That's a fact. Because people always like hearing stories about themselves. And I remember him telling that over close to Brickfields Temple there was a house which was haunted, had a ghost in it. I don't think they were Buddhists, but they tried the Christians and the other people, and nothing worked. We are really good. Buddhist monks are the best, number one, most powerful ghostbusters. When everything else fails, get a Buddhist monk in, works very well. So he went to chant at the house, and it sort of worked. The ghost left the house. But the problem was, it just moved next door. So the neighbours complained. So the poor old Chief Reverend had to go to every house in the street and chant at everyone to make sure the ghost never just moved next door, but moved out of the whole state. But suddenly you really coupled with ghosts. Movements of nexus next door, they go to the house next door and keep moving and come on. So that's very funny. Oh, you've got so tired sounding at all the neighbours' houses as well. So you don't need to be afraid. And that is the last question here. So only 5 minutes over. So that's pretty good. Right? So all of you who are on retreat, now is the time to go back to your rooms. Have a nice rest tonight. In the morning, please get up by at least 6 o'clock, isn't it? Come up earlier if you can and meditate. And have a nice time. Yeah? Quick. Announcement? Oh yeah, transference of merit. Okay, 2 names before we transfer merits.
2 names here I wanted to special mention. One of them is the late mother of Dr. Victor Lee, who just recently passed away, Madam Pang Tianqin, as well as the late grandmother of Alex Lim. Alex Lim is the head of the Hanjuta for this year, and he's also a key person to initiate this retreat, the late Madam T. Yang Ai, and also dedicate this merit of this retreat and the Dharma talk that we have listened tonight to all the departed ones. So I invite Ajahn to read this in your name.
Please chant along with him.
Ida me ya ti na o tu su ki ta o tu ya ta yo. Ida me ya ti na o tu su ki ta o tu ya ta yo. Ida me ya ti na o tu su ki ta.
And everyone gets really depressed. So please, every evening, 3 big sadhus, and that's the way to get. So have a good night, everybody. For those of you who have just come for the talk, another talk tomorrow night on right intention, the second factor. For those of you staying the night, have a beautiful, peaceful night.